Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give and then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks.
Congress is returning to Washington for one of the busiest weeks of the year. Lawmakers have to agree on some kind of spending plan to avoid a government shutdown next week. Key government programs like the National Flood Insurance Program are due to expire soon. Republicans are hoping to pass tax cuts by Christmas, but it's going to be close in the Senate, which might vote this week. And the day began with questions about who is running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because of dueling appointments. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, Robin.
And to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, on Friday, its Obama-appointed director resigned, appointed his deputy, Leandra English, as acting director. Hours later, the White House appointed Budget Director Mick Mulvaney to be interim chief, and both showed up for work this morning?
They did. It's an awkward situation, and it was, you know, you think about commuting to work and, you know, showing up and not having a boss or not knowing who to report to exactly.
Or having two bosses.
Yeah. I mean, so what winds up happening here is that English shows up earlier than Mulvaney. She sent an email to staff. Mulvaney showed up, by the way, with donuts in tow, hoping to, I guess, make a good first impression. But he's somebody who has had a lot of negative things to say about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And he's also running the Office of Management and Budget. So it's unclear how much of a strong role he thinks the CFPB should actually have. And people should realize this agency has 1,600 employees. They were the ones to kind of take the lead on the Wells Fargo scam accounts case. So they do a lot and was created under Dodd-Frank. And, you know, they both show up to work today. Mulvaney says to staff, ignore any communication from English. English submitted a lawsuit last night to try to determine which statute of the law weighs out, because Richard Cordray, who was President Obama's appointment there, wound up leaving on Friday. That statute, there's a statute that says that the deputy director would then take over if there was a vacancy. He named English his deputy director, therefore she would take over the agency. However, when the White House learned of this several hours later, they decided to put Mulvaney in charge. They had the Office of Legal Counsel weigh in at the Justice Department and say that that statute of about federal vacancies weighs out over supersedes over that other statute that says the deputy director would take over.
I'd love to be a fly on those walls and you get a donut. But we'll see how that plays out. But talk about the special election in December. It is coming up in Alabama. We learned today President Trump will not go there to campaign for the candidate Roy Moore, of course, accused of inappropriate behavior with teen girls years ago. Republicans Lindsey Graham, John Thune are calling for Moore to drop out. The president's making it clear he wants his supporters to vote for him instead of the Democrat. Here's, though, Thune on Fox News Sunday.
I would like to see the president come out and support what many of us have said, and that is that Roy Moore needs to step aside, allow somebody else to be a write-in candidate. We can win that seat.
Domenico, can they?
Well, you know, this is something of a 50-50 race at this point. It's hard to tell by polling who's going to be the person who could win here. You know, Democrats are worried that the Democrat in the race, Doug Jones, could have peaked a little too early, given that it's Alabama and there's a whole lot of Republicans in the state. It's very much not clear what's going to happen, but, you know, muddying the waters here was on Sunday, Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, going on Meet the Press and seeming to make excuses for John Conyers, the Michigan Democrat who is who has had sexual harassment allegations leveled against him and apparently settled a case with another woman who is accusing him of more serious charges than even, say, Al Franken, the senator from Minnesota, who was accused of sexual harassment.
We have that sound from NBC's Meet the Press. Let's just listen to a little of House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
Was it one accusation? Is it two? I think there has to be. John Conyers is an icon in our country. He has done a great deal to protect women.
And Domenico, I heard some analysts say that was maybe her way of maybe a deal in which she said those nice things. And then he did decide yesterday to step down from his role as the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult, though, for Democrats to claim the moral high ground when they say, well, you know, when Chuck Todd asks from NBC, do you believe the women? And she says, I don't know. Do you know who they are? Have they come forward? Yeah. They haven't come forward. That sounds like something Donald Trump would say, not the Democratic minority leader.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the tax cuts and the Senate plan. The president tweeting today that maybe just a little bit of tweaks here and there and it will pass. He might have been responding to a report over the weekend that said the poor people are actually going to be suffering far more than we'd previously thought by the Republican plans. Where do you think we are there?
One thing that's come out of the sexual harassment discussions has been sort of a papering over of the discussion of some of the details in the potential tax plan. And Republicans are trying to, you know, figure out ways to stick this thing inside of the $1.5 trillion that it can add to the federal deficit, which is why you hear about so many maneuvers and machinations. They got a little bit of a boost in the arm when Rand Paul said that he was going to vote for it, the senator from Kentucky, who's normally a budget hawk. And he did so because they included the Obamacare mandate repeal in there. You had Lisa Murkowski from Alaska also say that she was okay with the mandate repeal. She hasn't said if she'll come out in favor of this bill. But there are a lot of Republicans to watch, and they can only lose two. And there's a lot of things that they each want that sometimes are conflicting with each other.
Yeah. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, concluded that by 2019, people earning less than $30,000 a year would be worse off under the Senate bill. By 2027, people earning less than $75,000 would be worse off as well. We'll watch that this week. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it's been a little more than a year since President Trump was elected, and many analysts attribute his victory to his strength among white working class voters. But what does that term, white working class voters, really mean? And does it really explain Trump's victory? Sam Harnett from member station KQED reports.
The trickle began before the presidential election. After November 8th, the floodgates opened.
Donald Trump's swift and seemingly unstoppable rise was boosted largely from support of working class white Americans.
What drives the politics of the white working class is economic
especially
anxiety.
Especially for working class white voters, including voters from the Rust Belt.
White working class,
the white
support
from white working class.
Give me America's white working class!
After the election, Joan Williams, a professor at the University of California, Hastings, wrote an article in a book linking Trump to the white working class.
I think, yes, we should be talking about the white working class because that's why we have President Trump.
Williams argues that Democrats lost because they didn't have an economic platform that appealed to the white working class. So who exactly is she talking about? A big mix of people.
It's X-ray radiology technicians who give me my mammogram. It's plumbers. It's cab drivers.
Williams argues that the elite ignored these workers who have stagnated economically. They wanted change, so they voted for Trump. Katie Grimes is a theology professor at Villanova University who writes on race and gender. She says liberals are obsessing about the white working class because they want a simple story on why Trump won.
You know, it's a nice narrative, right, that somehow the reason why the Democrats didn't win is because they just weren't hard enough on economic issues.
But Grimes says it obscures other potential factors in Trump's victory, like race, gender, or media coverage. She says continually using the phrase white working class has another problem. It promotes the idea that there's a fundamental difference between white workers and those of other races.
So I think there's a working class, right? There are people who have similar class interests. And then there are racial groups, right? I have not seen any evidence that there is something economic about the experience of being a white member of the working class.
White working class has been a racially divisive term since it first appeared about 150 years ago. The phrase only came into existence because people wanted to differentiate between white workers and newly freed black slaves.
The first use I know of was actually was discussing the emancipation of enslaved people in Jamaica in 1834.
Catherine Connor Martin is with the Oxford English Dictionary. She says the term really started to become tied to politics in the 1960s, when politicians played up racial divides to get votes. And now?
Overwhelmingly, when people are using the phrase white working class, it seems to be in the context of electoral politics.
The idea that the white working class drove the results of our last presidential election has become broadly accepted. Nathan Richter is a partner at Wakefield Research. It conducted a survey to see how people understand and view the white working class.
U.S. adults overwhelmingly believe that the white working class had a bigger impact than other groups on the election of President Trump. 68% of U.S. adults feel this way.
But Richter says the working class category is so broad, it doesn't tell us that much. It doesn't refer to particular jobs or income levels. The official definition used by election pollsters is anyone over 25 without a four-year degree. But in reality, all kinds of people say working class describes them, including three-quarters of the people Richter surveyed.
These terms, you know, working class or white working class, are very useful as rhetoric, and they're effective tools for addressing large groups of Americans, but that's where their utility ends. As a population segment, they're almost meaningless.
While the term white working class is broad, it evokes a narrow image of today's workers, says Peter Ratcliffe.
The term white working class is, unfortunately, a caricature.
Ratcliffe is a labor historian at McAllister College. He says the term calls to mind someone who's blue-collar, works with their hands, masculine, an everyday American. But today, many workers are women and minorities, and they do service jobs, not manual labor. Ratcliffe says the term is nostalgic and imprecise.
But it's also the tip of an iceberg that might lead us into deeper analysis.
Ratcliffe says for a long time, America has avoided talking about class at all. Hopefully, he says, this imperfect term opens a conversation that has been shut for far too long. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Harnett in San Francisco.
HBO is premiering a new documentary tonight about the meth crisis in America, not to be confused with the opioid crisis. The film focuses on meth addicts in rural Arkansas, their families devastated by the drug. It's called Meth Storm, and joining us from New York is filmmaker Brent Renaud. Welcome.
Thank you.
And from Arkansas, his brother Craig. Craig, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And I have to say right at the top, this was a very difficult film to watch right from the beginning, but also a very important topic. Why did the two of you decide to focus on this topic at this time?
Like a lot of our films, the gestation can go back as far as a decade. And something like a decade ago, we had embedded ourselves in a burn unit near Memphis, Tennessee. And it became obvious to us very quickly that most of the patients on the burn unit were kids, and they were kids with burns on their faces and on their hands and on their arms and on their torsos. And most of their parents had the same explanation that they were burning trash in the yard, which is pretty common in this part of Arkansas, and the kids threw gasoline or lighter fluid onto the fire, and it kind of blew up in their face. And, you know, this seems plausible to me, but the doctor said, no, actually, it's most of these kids are the victims of meth lab explosions. And we thought that was really interesting. And it wasn't long after that that the legislatures around the South started passing laws so that Sudafed, one of the ingredients needed in meth labs, was made so that you had to have an ID and you had to buy it over the counter, and you could only buy a couple of packs per month, not enough to run a meth lab. That, and along with some police operations, it pretty much shut down the American meth industry as we knew it up to that point. And for a while, things seemed kind of positive. But not long after that, a friend of mine who was a police officer in Arkansas, he started telling us that he was now arresting people. Former meth cooks were now dealers for the cartels. And one family in particular, with the matriarch Veronica, who you see in the film, he introduced us to her, and they had been arrested a lot. And he introduced us, and we started spending some time with them and really getting to know them.
Right.
And we thought, you know, this is pretty interesting. We in a sense, we know the cops and we know the robbers, and we have access to both of them. And there's something really interesting there.
And while the meth used to be cooked up in these meth labs, you're saying now a lot of it is coming in from Mexico. And the towns that you focus on in this documentary are places in Arkansas that I'd never even heard of. These are tiny little towns where everybody's on drugs.
Yeah, you know, I think the film is as much about poverty in the state as it is about meth addiction. And you have this perfect storm of these large amounts of methamphetamine coming in at the same time that you have a loss of job opportunities and not a lot of things going on in these communities. You know, and you hear the DEA in the film talk about, you know, back in the days of meth labs, they would be surprised that they saw, you know, a pound at a time, and now they're seeing 40 to 50 pound shipments a week coming into Arkansas. And so the problem has gotten very overwhelming in these communities.
Well, you mentioned that it is about the economy. I want to play a clip from the film. This is the drug enforcement agent, Johnny Sally. He's also mayor of the town. And he says that the economy of the area does not offer a lot of alternatives to dealing meth.
Our economy went down after Walmart came to Clinton. This building just recently collapsed like this a couple of years ago. And it was one of our oldest buildings still left. This was a grocery store here. We had a gas station there. There was a furniture factory here in town.
Now, I don't want to pick on Walmart here, but did that really play a role in the meth crisis that came in and a lot of stores went out of business, people lost their jobs?
Well, you know, it's one of the factors. There's really been a perfect storm of things that have happened in this area and made it difficult to get jobs. And what we're looking at now is a situation in which the kids in this film, you hear the sheriff say, I don't think they had a choice to do anything but get involved with the drug trade. We've got kids who are now becoming teenagers. They've never known anyone who's had a job, never known anyone who's gone to college. What do we expect of these kids when we're not giving them any of their opportunities? And it's kind of interesting that their mother, Veronica, she's kind of from the previous generation, and she can kind of give us perspective on that.
Let's listen to a little bit of Veronica. You know, we see her shooting up. We see her with her kids doing drugs. Here she is talking about why she can't give up meth.
You're hurting so bad, you go get some dope and do a bump, and you don't hurt no more. There is an endless supply of addicts that'll sell it. And there's more addicts every day.
One of the things that I was wondering as I was watching this is why can't people like Veronica and her family members and others stop when they realize how bad it is for them?
Well, I think Teddy in the film, her son, is a perfect example of this. You know, we watched Teddy come out of jail 3 different times through the course of making this film. You know, and even after doing 90-day treatment programs, coming out very sincerely wanting to stop, you know, but we would watch him go back to these communities where everybody that he knows in that community is either using or dealing. You watch him go through sincere attempts to get a job, to try to get his life back together for his kids. And then slowly the pressures of that environment, you know, family members on it and everybody else on it, and not being able to get a consistent job. And I think eventually he just gives in. And I think that's indicative of the problem for a lot of people that just can't get off the drug.
It's the forgotten America. And we've seen it in other places like inner city Chicago as well, where there really are very few job opportunities. The educational opportunities are not very good. Your role models are involved in the drug industry, and you get a record at a very young age. And once you've got that record, it dogs you for life.
You mentioned Teddy. I want to take a listen here to one more clip from the film. This is Teddy talking about what family life is like.
Not long ago, I was sitting, you know, in the same room shooting dope with my mom, to where most other families are probably sitting there talking, watching a movie. We're all sitting there, you know, talking about, oh, mine's, you know, how thick the shot of dope is. And I look back now, that's not normal. That's not normal. You know, I'm starting to see a lot of things in my life was not normal.
How much of a connection do you think there is between the meth crisis that you portray in this film and the opioid crisis that we're hearing about all across the country?
Well, I think there's definitely a connection in terms of the way the United States is being flooded with these drugs. You know, we watched the DEA for 2 years in Arkansas really struggling with keeping up with the mass amounts that are coming in. And you do these massive operations to take down one network, and they're immediately replaced by other people who are willing to step up and deal the drugs. And so I think that's a big problem that you're having with the opioid crisis and the methamphetamine crisis.
You know, another interesting point that you make in this film, we hear about the cartels coming in, and when somebody gets caught from the cartel, they're replaced within a few days in rural Arkansas?
Certainly, yeah. And, you know, a lot of this is mid-level dealers who live in the state who are getting these larger quantities from the cartels that are bringing it in. And so, especially at the mid-level dealers, there's a very plentiful supply of people willing to step up because of the money that can be made in an economy where there's not a lot of other opportunities.
You know, most of the meth dealers are former meth cooks, and it's no longer profitable to cook methamphetamine in the United States for what it costs them to get the materials that they need, even if they can get the materials to cook meth. The Mexican cartels can send in a much cheaper product than that and much more pure and much more addictive. And so most of these cooks have now gone, and they work for the cartels. And a lot of the distribution networks that were there in place previously have now been kind of co-opted by the larger cartels.
So what do you think will end this cycle?
I think education and jobs in these failing economies could help quite a bit in terms of giving an incentive to do something different. You know, you hear Daniel, Veronica's son, in the film talk about if he had a regular job, he would stop. You know, and so I think that could help quite a bit.
You know, our goal, there's so much, you know, in the larger culture around us in social media, so much judgment and so much analysis and so much throwing dirt on everyone. And I think that our work is really a reaction against that. We're trying to present stories from the subject's point of view, very experiential stories, so that when people start having opinions about police officers or low-level drug addicts or even rural people in general, we're hoping to give a little bit of context to those discussions.
Did anything give you hope in the making of this film?
Yeah, I think there always has to be hope. You know, I think the people that are approaching their jobs, whether it's the law enforcement in these communities, especially, you know, with the local law enforcement here, their families are being affected. And so this isn't just them going out and enforcing the drug laws. This is them trying to stop the erosion of their communities through drug abuse. And so that certainly gave me a lot of hope to see how sincerely that they are approaching that problem and how sympathetically they're approaching it. You know, you can see the way that they interact with the people they're arresting. You know, they treat them like their neighbors because often that's what they are. You know, Johnny talks in the film that half the people he's arresting are either people that he grew up with or the kids of people he grew up with. So, you know, I think that gives me hope that they're approaching this from the community level and trying to help save their communities from this problem.
Well, it is a very powerful documentary. Filmmakers Brent and Craig Renaud. The film is called Meth Storm. It premieres tonight on HBO. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thanksgiving is a time of homecoming, and over the weekend there was a special one in a Massachusetts community about 20 miles north of Boston. Here now's Alex Ashlock was there.
Shalane Flanagan was a hero in her hometown of Marblehead, Massachusetts, a long time before she did this.
Look at the emotion of Shalane Flanagan as she comes to the line.
Flanagan made history on November 5th. She won the New York City Marathon, the first American woman to win that race in 40 years. She crossed the finish line in tears. The win represented a pinnacle of sorts for Flanagan's long-running career. After graduating high school in 2000, she won NCAA championships at the University of North Carolina, and later added an Olympic medal. But New York was her first big city marathon win, and it came at the age of 36.
That dream started as a little girl, and I just felt like I couldn't give up on the dream. I just felt like, you know, there definitely were some low moments where I thought, like, maybe this is never going to happen for me. And I felt like right as I was about ready to just feel like I was about to give up, I just thought, like, you know, maybe the next one is around the corner. That's my big moment. And thankfully, I prepared as if it was, and things worked out for me. And so it just shows that really great things don't always come easy.
As part of Shalane Flanagan Day in Marblehead, more than 1,000 other runners joined her for a 5K road race. It was a benefit for the Marblehead Track Association, which supports running in the community. Doug Williams is a member of the association's board. He says Flanagan's win in New York really added some extra juice to this year's race.
People who don't know anything about running became very aware when she won New York. It's the biggest stage for the sport. So the fact that that happened there was an amazing opportunity. We're focused on building our running community, and she just allows us to do that in an even bigger way.
Everyone wanted a picture with Flanagan as she greeted runners at the finish line of the 3-mile race. Among them, many young girls who said they are running today because they were inspired by Flanagan's example. That includes Haley Groey.
Because she can run fast, and she won the New York Marathon.
Haley was running with her mother, Kristen.
She had never really run a 5K before, right? Until the first race, because she does Fit Girls Run Club through her school. And so it's pretty inspirational to see someone like Shalane from your hometown win when you never thought you could run a 5K at all, right? And now here she is for her second 5K race.
Yeah.
Joining Flanagan at the finish line was Mary Wittenberg, past president of the New York Roadrunners. For many years, she helped oversee the New York Marathon and made the trip to Marblehead for Flanagan's special day.
What a great opportunity to come out here and see a community so uplifted by one of their own. And, you know, Shalane is such a giver, and to see her out here hugging every single person and high five. And I'm looking at these kids, and it's so exciting because they know, you know, they can grow up and they can be Shalane too in their own world, maybe. You know, just Shalane's a good example. Just keep going.
And that's what Flanagan has done throughout her running career. She kept going, kept running, and it paid off on the streets of New York City on November 5th.
This is what you dream of, is moments like this where, you know, you can have lifetime achievements and celebrate it with people that you really care about and a community that helped you get there.
For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlaw.
The Irish border, the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of Britain, and the Irish Republic, which is independent, has been open and fluid between the two for years. But will it have to harden if Britain and Northern Ireland exit the EU and the Irish Republic doesn't? Rob Watson, the BBC political correspondent, is in London. Rob, there are those saying there'd have to be a hardened border. What would that mean for trade, for security?
Well, it's one of the many curveballs thrown up by Britain's decision to vote to leave the European Union. And I guess it's also one of those cases which has got lots of people who are on the Remain side of the camp saying, we told you, we said this one might be a tricky one. To try and put this as simply as possible, with Britain still inside the European Union, along with the other 27 members, including the Irish Republic, essentially, we're in a customs union. And so that just means any goods, any services, any people, they just cross between those 28 countries. Absolutely no problem at all. And they also have a unified external tariff. What I mean by that is, let's say you import a banana into the UK, you pay the same tax on it as if you'd imported it into Ireland. So things can just sort of whiz around all very happily. Now, of course, with Britain leaving the European Union and saying it's not going to be in this little customs union, or I should say this rather big customs union, suddenly you have the prospect of a border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. Now, perhaps in other countries this might not be a problem, but given that the history of problems and tensions and given the nature of the peace agreement in Northern Ireland, I mean, this is a real whopper.
Well, people are worried that this might cause a return to that period known as the Troubles, when there was bloody conflict over British rule in Northern Ireland, the conflict between Catholics who wanted to unite with the Republic of Ireland and Protestants who wanted to stay with Britain. So this might open that wound?
I mean, I think that would be at the extreme end. I guess I'd put it a different way, Robin, and that is the day before the Brexit referendum, so on 22nd of June 2016, I think people would have said, look, the relations between Dublin and London and between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic are better than they'd been in decades and decades. And now, of course, certain politicians, certainly Brexit politicians, Brexit-supporting politicians, have been saying very rude things about Irish politicians who've been warning about the dangers of Brexit. So maybe not going back to armed conflict, but I mean, people have warned that, let's say you had a hard border post, let's say you had some sort of a watchtower in, on the border between the north and the south in Ireland, maybe someone might be minded to attack it.
Yeah, it's even just symbolically, it seems like lots of security, barbed wire, border fences.
The thing is, Robin, both sides, neither London nor Dublin want this. Nobody wants it. People are saying, yeah, we can't have a hard border. But here's the problem. It's just a question of international law, because you see, if Britain leaves the European Union, as is intended in 2019, it'll be a third party. And whether anybody wanted a border or not, it will be up to the Republic of Ireland to collect customs duties on behalf of the European Union. Now, what the Brits have been saying, Brexiteers have been saying, is, oh, don't worry, we'll think of some technological solution and this will all get sorted out, hopefully, if Britain gets a good trade deal with the EU. But of course, there are plenty of people in the Irish Republic who are simply not convinced.
And by the way, just paint the picture of the border for us now. I mean, is it a place where people you know, are families separated by it? Is it, you know, is it very fluid, that space where Northern Ireland meets the Irish Republic?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I've been there quite a few times. Mm-hmm. It's as if there was nothing there at all.
Right.
I mean, it's about 300 miles long, some of it through the most gorgeous countryside you've ever seen. I think there are some houses where you've got one room which is in the Irish Republic and another one that's in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. So I think you get the picture. It's pretty wild. It's pretty rural. And people just go forwards, backwards and forwards as if there was nothing there. And of course, one of the real problems would be for farming, because both the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland, very, very rural, very agricultural based economies. I mean, the idea that you'd have checks on sort of ducks and geese and cows, I mean, goodness only knows, that would be a real problem.
Well, but the EU is saying the UK has to have an acceptable solution ahead of the Brexit summit next month. A, do you think that's going to happen? And B, where are we on Brexit? I mean, is this a done deal?
Goodness, Robin, I'll try and keep it short. I mean, some people have said, will the Irish prevent the talks moving ahead to this, the future of Britain's relationship with the European Union in December? I just don't know. I mean, it's obviously a matter of great importance to the Irish Republic. I mean, to talk more generally about the process, I mean, I think most people, if they were looking from the outside, would say that Britain's position continues to be pretty chaotic and its handling of the process pretty chaotic for one very good reason, and that is that the British government, because of its own internal divisions, has yet to decide on absolutely the most critical thing, Robin, and that is what on earth should Britain's future relationship with the European Union be? Should it be a really, really close relationship, or should it be rather more distant? And what an awful lot of Britain's partners in Europe are saying, for goodness sake, just figure out what it is you want, and then we'll try and do some business.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be with you.
Well, let's go now to the coasts of Oregon and Washington State. The last time there was a major earthquake there was in 1700, but scientists say another can occur there maybe soon. So some communities are working to move key infrastructure to higher ground. This month in La Push, Washington, the Quileute tribe has started moving its seaside village out of the tsunami and flood zone. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network went for a look.
Quileute Tribal School Superintendent Mark Jacobson has a view of the Pacific Ocean to die for. He'd prefer that stay just a figure of speech, though.
I can hit a golf ball from my office into the surf, and I'm no Tiger Woods.
Out his window, the waves crash on a majestic beach framed by craggy islands. Eagles often fly by. Invisible, just beyond the horizon, the Cascadia earthquake fault, primed to unleash a megaquake and tsunami.
It's beautiful today, but what about if I see that big wave coming? It wouldn't be very pretty then. It would be pretty disastrous and pretty frightening.
And how often do you think about this?
Every day I come in here. Isn't a day goes by, I don't think that, because you don't know when it's coming.
The K-12 school Jacobson runs is the only one on the Quileute Reservation. The tribal government says relocating the school is a matter of life or death for the Quileute people. Now, land clearing is underway for phase one of the Quileute's move to higher ground. It took an act of Congress to make it possible for the loggers, truck drivers, and dozer operators to go to work. The Quileutes lobbied to tweak the boundaries of Olympic National Park to add higher elevations to their 1 square mile reservation. It's surrounded by National Park on three sides and the ocean on the fourth. The tribe says no residents of their small fishing village will be forced to relocate. Some elders in the lower village told me they support moving the school, but they personally intend to stay. Quileute elder Beverly Loudon says she puts her faith in God, whatever comes.
The majority of the people that are down here now are going to stay here because they don't want to uproot, and they've been here for many, many generations.
The Quileute tribe is not alone in planning a move to safer ground. Down the Washington state coast, the main village of the Quinault Nation, Tohola, is similarly situated at a river mouth facing the ocean. The Quinaults have begun clearing land inland to relocate key buildings. Voters in Seaside, Oregon, last year approved a bond measure to move three schools out of the tsunami zone. Back on the Quileute Reservation, project manager Susan Devine says the tribe's priorities are to get children out of harm's way first by moving the school, then the elders by relocating the senior center, and then government offices and housing.
The heart will stay in the lower village, but the day-to-day functions, the safety of where the children are living and going to school, and people's jobs are, they will move up to higher ground.
Devine says only the relocation of the tribal school is financed, thanks to a federal grant. Scrounging up money to move the rest of the village will take many years. But the fact they've broken ground now makes tribal council member James Jackson Sr. feel good.
You know, just to see the timber on the ground up there is it's a wonderful thing to see, you know, to be able to try to get, you know, everybody up to safety, because you just never know when that's going to happen. You know, you don't want it to happen, but, you know, if we can prevent it, save lives, I mean, that's the ultimate goal.
For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi, reporting from La Push, Washington.
The price of Bitcoin is hovering around $10,000 today. So far this year, the cryptocurrency's value has gone up more than 800%, doing far better than the stock market overall, which has also been on a tear. It's grown so much that banks like Goldman Sachs, while skeptical, are considering taking Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies a little more seriously. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And it's just unbelievable to watch Bitcoin go up by so much so fast. Yesterday, it broke the $9,000 mark. Today, we're talking about $10,000. What's going on?
I suppose I can be either honest or helpful here. The honest answer is I am not 100% sure what's going on, and I don't think anybody's 100% sure what's going on. The more helpful answer from conversations with people who are both advocates of Bitcoin and skeptics of Bitcoin, it seems to be that speculation is the primary driver here. This is an exciting product with a rather ingenious underlying technology in the blockchain itself, which is this sort of distributed digital ledger of digital payments. But you look right now at the currency's recent growth, it seems to be driven by soaring demand in Asia. It seems to be driven by hype effects here in the United States, online buy Bitcoin, recently overtook buy gold as an online search phrase. And like gold, I think it represents a way for people to hedge against equities and more traditionally traded stocks. So I think in many ways, this is a bit of a frenzy. And it's a frenzy where a lot of experts are trying to figure out exactly what is going on and why.
But you're saying that it's really about investment. Bitcoin is an investment. It's not something that people are buying so that they can buy other things.
Yes, this is a question. This is the million-dollar question. Is Bitcoin best thought of as a stock or as a currency? And if you define success as a huge market cap with national radio interest, then clearly, yeah, cryptocurrencies are an enormous success as an investment. The value has doubled in just the last 40 or 45 days. The harder question to answer, though, is whether or not it's a good currency. And there, I'm just not really sure. It's not entirely obvious that use of Bitcoin, that transactions involving Bitcoin are rising anything near like the overall market cap of the product.
And by the way, it's not just Bitcoin. The other cryptocurrencies like Ethereum are also doing very well, not as well as Bitcoin, but very well.
That's right. And, you know, in thinking about this question, you know, is this a good currency? Is it best to think of this as a currency? Maybe the best answer here is to use a little bit of Econ 101. Two of the properties of any given currency are something called medium of exchange and store of value. Medium of exchange says the currencies exist so people can buy and sell stuff, and it's good for facilitating that. Store of value means that the currency won't lose buying power. And the paradox of Bitcoin, to me, is that it's an incredible store of value. It's a store of ever increasing value. But ironically, that makes it a terrible currency. After all, Jeremy, if I gave you a coin, a literal coin, not like Bitcoin, but a physical coin, I said its value is going to keep doubling every week or so, but maybe not. Who knows? Good luck. Would you spend it on coffee or a pair of pants or an interior redecoration? Like, the answer is maybe never. You'd want to hold on to it to see how valuable it gets. So this is what people mean when they say that Bitcoin seems to be more like a bubble than a currency. The dollar is a really useful medium of exchange because it's worth a dollar day after day. But Bitcoin is doubling every 45 days, which makes it kind of difficult to see currently, today, as a proper currency.
Right. And I guess if you go by that logic and you want to hold on to it to see how high it goes, you could also get really unlucky and it could crash.
Oh, that's right. It's highly volatile. Exactly.
Right. Now, let's talk about Wall Street's reaction to all of this, because Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, has said investing in Bitcoin is stupid and he's not going to talk about Bitcoin anymore. Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs seems to be open to trading it at Goldman. Tell us more about what Wall Street is saying about Bitcoin.
Well, the fact that Dimon and Blankfein at J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs seem to be on completely opposite sides of this debate, I think, goes right to the first thing that I said, which is that for anybody to attest that they have absolute certainty about what's going on in this market would be an obvious lie. Now, on the one hand, Jamie Dimon might be proved incredibly prescient by history if this thing crashes by 80% in the next few months. On the other hand, look, if someone came into Jamie Dimon in February and said, sir, we're not sure how to play the Trump economy. We don't know about tax reform. We don't know about this White House. But my team and I have done some research, and we'd like to stake out a large position in Bitcoin. Well, that bet just tripled in value. And I don't think Jamie Dimon would be too upset about having a stake in anything that has tripled in value. What's at stake here is money. And Jamie Dimon is essentially saying, by calling it stupid, he's really saying, I don't get it, right? I don't understand the underlying fundamentals here. And because I don't understand it, I'm going to call it stupid because I think that it has to prove itself to be a bubble that busts. I think Jamie Dimon is probably right, but again, first thing I said, I don't know. This is a new technology. This isn't a tulip. This isn't gold. This isn't silver. This isn't a product that has existed for millions or billions of years. Right. This is something that was invented a few years ago. It's a brand new technology, and we don't know the degree to which cryptocurrencies are going to be a feature of the future of the economy or just a blip that people right. in 10 years say, oh, remember in 2017 when that whole thing happened.
That's Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
It's Here Now.